major indices are nearing January's record levels as stocks continue their gains this morning. But is there still too much of a reliance on big tech?
John, you know, there still is plenty of reliance on big tech in terms of the year-to-date numbers. I wouldn't say it's outsized reliance. So it's kind of a nuanced answer. Rough numbers, the U.S. stock market measured by the S&P 500 is up about $1.2 trillion in value year-to-date. About $600 billion of that, so about half of that, comes from FANG with a double A. Apple plus FANG. Now, Facebook has basically been a push. So it's really four stocks that have done that.
Goldman Sachs saying that share buybacks have surged 80% year to date.
It's not just a big year for earnings. You know, it's a big year for buybacks as well. Now, Goldman Sachs estimates that buybacks could hit a record $1 trillion this year. That's a rise of 46% from last year.
We know the president likes big round numbers on trade, but there needs to be a lot of evidence behind the decision to make policies like this.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the FANGs and technology stocks continue to power the markets higher. Stock buybacks are also driving stocks up, but we still have some turbulence as we saw on this Friday, especially on the trade front. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, John Roque will be joining us. He says that basically we've got a topping process going on, and also there are problems, as we've been discussing here, that we see in emerging markets. Oil could also be topping, according to John. He sees some similarities. The momentum just isn't as strong, but he's also monitoring bank indexes. Out of the 10 around the globe, there's only two of them that are doing well. And he's a little bit dubious about small cap stocks in the Russell 2000. Also joining me in the first hour will be Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman. He says the dollar is probably going to break out and head higher, but he's a little bit cautious here. We're seeing some major breakdowns in the euro, and we're seeing it in currencies, especially in the Turkish lira, as we saw on Friday. He's going to talk about that. He's in the cautious camp as he sees political issues coming up this fall. So he's going to be waiting on the sidelines. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. All of that is coming up in the first hour.
I'm Chris Prytower, and in the second hour, we're going to go inside the bubble and explain why defense wins championships. We're going to focus on investment strategy. What do you do in an uncertain market? Do you hold? Do you trade? What does an investor do? If you're anxious, make sure you stay tuned for hour two when we go inside the bubble. Now let's turn to Ryan Poplava for the weekly wrap-up report on the drivers and catalysts that moved the market this week. Ryan, what do you think about the Turkish lira falling the way it did so precipitously on Friday? Do you think that was a result of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Turkey falling out over the detained U.S. pastor with an increase in tariffs on steel and aluminum? Or is this just a reaction as a result of something more economically dire?
Well, Chris, the weakness in the lira has been developing for some time, even though it was just kind of headline news here on Friday. It's been a subject we've been talking about on the wrap-up report. And not just the lira, but many other currencies that have been just ailing and weakening versus the dollar, like specifically the Chinese yuan. But the lira weakness became headline news on Friday when there was an article in the Financial Times basically stating that the currency weakness in the lira is a problem for European banks. And this is the same debt service worry Chris Poplava has been talking about in our big picture and some of the newsletters we've been writing to clients all summer long. And he's been on the show talking about it specifically on Insider. So as your currency falls, it gets more expensive to service your debt with interest payments and reissuances when your debt is priced in foreign currencies. And that fear then carries that any holders of that Turkish debt will find a higher risk in carrying that debt. In the IMF, I was looking at this week's, one of their latest estimates show that total debt priced in foreign currencies for Turkey is more than 50% of GDP. So if you follow European bank indices, where the majority of Turkish debt is held, you'll find that due to the issues with Brexit, the political uncertainty in Italy that we've discussed well back into spring, that looks like it's improving regarding their budget. And now Turkey, the bank index has not done well. The Eurostock bank index is down around 23% from the January high. And due to this week, is back within, I would say, 2 points of the low this year. And I actually have a chart of that, which you can find on this episode over on financialsense.com.
So additionally, on Friday, after the Turkish delegation left, by the way, without a solution on the jailed pastor, Trump tweeted a doubling of tariffs on steel and aluminum of 20 and 50% respectively.
Yeah, Chris, and with the increased tariffs and currency weakness, there comes the other issue, inflation. Consumer prices, I saw in July alone, were up around 16%.
Okay, so with that being the case, what is Turkey, the ECB, or for that matter, anybody doing at this point to stem the tide?
So far, nobody outside of Turkey has done anything. We haven't heard anything from the European Central Bank, but the Turkish Central Bank, their move to lower reserve requirements to promote some liquidity into the banking sector earlier this week. And then the Turkish Treasury said they were lowering their growth goals from 5.5% GDP down to 4% or less than 4%, which meant that, hey, we're going to have to borrow less at this point. Ultimately, their president has turned Friday to the citizens saying, hey, let's sell gold, US dollars, and let's buy our currency. Unfortunately, at this point, it doesn't seem like investors are happy with any of these steps yet, obviously looking at the currency and the results we're seeing there. While we're on the subject of debt and Europe, things are developing well in Italy, like I kind of alluded to earlier. And we've been seeing there was a couple of meetings with high officials. They basically said they've come to an agreement on financial planning to control their spending, and they plan to announce that or present it really in September. But with their exposure to Turkey, the announcement kind of did very little to help the banking index, like I previously mentioned, or the Turkish lira. But it is a positive note, and that the Bank of Italy stated this week that their target to net liabilities balance showed a drop of down to $471 billion in July and has since been stable since mid-June. So that's a good sign.
Well, Ryan, most of what I hear you talking about, it seems to be international banking and financial concerns over debt servicing. You mentioned trade wars, inflation, but through most of that news this year, it seems we've been relatively unscathed.
Yeah, Chris, that continues to be the case. Primarily as a result of the tax cuts that we implemented towards December, we've been near full employment, high consumer sentiment across the board. Retail sales were doing very well back in November and has been a very strong sector all year long. And of course, earnings are on point. The earnings season is slowing down. There were only about 44 companies in the S&P 500 reporting this week. But thus far, if you look at the 452 that have reported, around 83% have beat on earnings and 70% on revenues. So that's very high. In fact, I did just a little digging and recently showed that revenue growth has almost hit double digits now at around 10% for the first time in 7 years. So that's not just stock buybacks, which helps earnings. That's companies raising prices and showing the ability to pass higher input costs that have been kind of concerning us since February when we got that first employment report showing average hourly earnings going up quite a bit. So overall, again, we continue to always say the U.S. is the best house in a bad neighborhood.
So it sounds like the earnings season is starting to wind down. Now, Ryan, if you say that it started on July 10th, the S&P 500, let's see here, it looks like it's up about 1.4%, but we had rallied leading up to this point. This week, we were only just 12 points shy of the January closing high for the S&P 500. It really looks like we're just a stone's throw away. So, Ryan, is there anything else important that hit the market news this week that you'd like to review?
Real quickly, Chris, the main thing I'd say here is that with the Turkish lira kind of hitting front page news on Friday, this is the kind of the first time that I've seen the market respond negatively to some of the developments we've been talking about all summer long. this could be just the first shot across the bow, maybe for a summer correction. Typically, August does not have historically very good statistical returns, where typically it's negative. But the spotlight, like I said, was really on the Turkish lira Friday. But I'm a lot more worried about the depreciation in the yuan, the Chinese yuan, and the weakness in their equity market, which is down more than 20%, and the slowdown in their manufacturing PMIs, which we've talked about that first week of every month, looking back. And still no agreement between the U.S. and China on trade. Of course, we continue to see both of them are kind of digging in their heels. There was some intervention going on this week. The People's Bank of China imposed a reserve requirement of 20% on trading yuan forward contracts, making it really more expensive to short. But that didn't seem to really stabilize things yet either. So we continue to see a weakness there in their currency. Of course, that's helping their exports. We saw some really good export numbers recently this week. And of course, the trade war just really continues. Each week, we see an escalation. So another worrying aspect this week is that Russia's Putin has called the new U.S. sanctions that are being discussed in Congress and being levied against them for two different things: their election meddling and in response to a nerve agent attack on a former Russian spy in Britain. Basically, those two things, we are announcing some sanctions pretty soon here. And they have alluded that that's really a declaration of economic war. Their ruble has tumbled recently on that news and has been in decline since May, if I'm looking at the chart here. Their economy has done well with higher energy prices, but needless to say that this is yet another currency weakening against the dollar, and the sanctions will limit goods and sensitive technology to Russia starting on August 22nd, it looks like.
Well, Ryan, how would you summarize everything that's going on now with currencies, trade wars, even the possibility of the contagion spreading? I'm hearing a lot of folks talk about contagion.
Well, Chris, if our listeners come away with anything from this wrap-up report, it's from our analysis that if you look at falling domestic currencies, make it very difficult to pay back debt payable in foreign currencies. And now you're looking at a country like Turkey, where that's 50% of their debt, and that becomes more expensive to pay your interest and to reissue debt. The interest rates can rise as a default risk becomes a problem, compounding the issue. And then the contagion spreads. Like you said, contagion is the word, but the idea is that this spreads to those holdings, those basically holding that debt as debt insurance costs go up. That's called credit default swaps. We're seeing those on the charts. So falling currencies also mean imports become more expensive, driving inflation higher, not to mention tariffs doing the exact same thing as well. So the U.S. has great interest rates right now compared to other developing nations, and that's encouraging funds to leave abroad and come here, again, compounding this kind of reflexive issue with weakening currencies abroad, strengthening U.S. dollar. And just as an aside, this week, one of the Federal Reserve's presidents, Evans, this week said, it would not surprise me if we make a judgment to move to a somewhat restrictive setting on rates. And, you know, he's a dove. And so a dove to say that this situation, that interest rate differential between us and our neighbors is going to just widen again, strengthening the dollar, compounding the issues that many of these countries are facing with their debt payable in U.S. dollars. So again, this is a major issue so far. No end in sight to it. Yes, we might not be talking about it on Monday, but that doesn't change it on the charts. And then Evans said that his neutral rate right now is around 2.75% for the federal funds rate. So we have some room before, I guess you can call it, it's restrictive, like he's saying, but it really is just around the corner, Chris, and that could be eventually next year at this rate.
Well, Ryan, thank you for that report. And maybe next time we meet next week, maybe the S&P 500 will exceed that January closing high. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Today, millions and millions of people have Bitcoin. Its market cap is in the hundreds of billions. It exists as a thing. But that's really just the starting phase. We're really building a new type of internet, And this internet comes with scarce digital goods. If you think about the web in the 2000s and what it did to file sharing and music and film and books, basically made them free because you can distribute them infinitely to anybody. And what the new web can do through blockchain-based systems is have digital files that are scarce. So if I give you a piece of music, I no longer have it once I give it to you.
Should you buy and hold at market tops? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and to minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things that matter most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Give us a call at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
Well, the stock market, even though it's been going back and forth, well, you could be doing pretty well, depending on which index and which stocks you are buying. Things like technology, consumer discretionary have been doing well this year. Things like the NASDAQ are also up along with the FANG stocks. But the industrial stocks like the Dow and the blue chips are having a little bit more difficulty. Joining me on the program is John Roque. And John, you sent us a bunch of charts, which we're going to put up on our program so our listeners can kind of follow us along as we go through these charts. But let's talk about the first one you sent me, which is a chart of Brent crude going all the way back to 1974. Explain to me what this chart is telling you, because below it, you have some momentum indicators that are not as high as previous high points that we've seen in oil.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me on again. So the chart I've sent over is for Brent crude, not West Texas, but certainly this could apply to West Texas. And what I've done is it's just a monthly chart using a logarithmic scale in Excel, because I wanted to be able to show the moves to a greater degree and have them show up on some percentage basis as well. And you could see that each of the key points in the chart at the top are annotated with the respective years for either tops and or bottoms. And I put in 2018 because I think that the oil move from the 2016 low is in the process of ending. And the bottom chart shows a corresponding momentum indicator also annotated with the appropriate years that correspond with the above years for the most part. And as you noted, Jim, the 2018 peak, while it got to over 75%, near 100%, happened at a level lower than in 2011, right in line with 05, lower than in 2000, et cetera. And it's never really got to the great overbought that we saw in prior cycles. And it suggests to me that the rally off of the 2016 low, while it has been impressive, really wasn't exceptionally strong compared to some historical moves. And now my momentum indicator is slowly weakening and deteriorating. So it suggests to me that the price for Brent, and then, of course, I can extend it out to the price for West Texas, should weaken here going forward.
John, you know what was surprising looking at your momentum indicator is, I think back to 2008 when oil prices got to $150 a barrel, but looking at your momentum indicator, it wasn't as high as it was, for example, in 1990, 2000, and 2011, even though the price was higher.
Yeah, so I think the way we should probably be thinking about this is that the low, I guess, from 2001 into about 2005 or so was really the big move. And then it had a little pullback and then accelerated again. And that last acceleration into the 2008 high, price high, was unconfirmed by the momentum indicator, which, of course, would have caused us to say, hopefully at that time, we have a negative divergence or an unconfirmed high. And it would have really sort of shot out an amber flashing light and told us that we need to be cautious about that high. So I think it's because it happened after a little pullback and then you reaccelerated out and the momentum indicator just couldn't catch up.
So even though if I was to look at a price of WTI or Brent, it looks like it's an upward trend. Looking at your momentum indicator, it's telling you that at some point we're going to begin to stall and this could reverse.
Yeah, and this is merely just one momentum indicator, and I'm sure anybody could do this on any system that they use, Bloomberg or TradeSense, anything that they'd like to, and put up any number of momentum indicators, and I'm sure that they'd find agreement that the price action or the momentum for Brent or West Texas has started to roll. That in and of itself is not a sell signal. It's just an amber flashing light that says it's not likely that the price levels for the item, and of course right here we're talking about Brent, can be sustained at this level. And then of course you want to be a little bit more aggressive and say it's likely that the next important move is lower, not higher.
All right, let's move on to your next chart, which is the Russian trading system. What is this showing you?
Well, of course, there have been fireworks, so to speak, this week with emerging market currency weakness. And we're going to get to the next chart, which I actually think is more interesting because the setup was just so darn technically beautiful. But you have some real deterioration here, Jim, for the Russian trading system, which is priced in dollars. And of course, the weakness is occurring here right in line with ruble weakness versus the dollar. And if my history is correct for this, it likely means that this market here is commodity sensitive and probably has some effect or will have some be affected by weakness in oil as well. And so if you looked at this here on a better scale, and I realize the scaling here to the left isn't so terrific, the 1000 level, and right now it's priced at 1060, is a key level for this Russian trading system index. And below there, which I think is a pretty decent, not hyperbolic, fairly conservative call, means that the Russian market's got some important downside ahead of it. It's down 7.3% on the week. It's down 3.3% today. It's some nasty action, and it wouldn't surprise me if the weakness here continued. And 1,000 on this index is a very important level, and I think it won't hold.
You know, I just wonder, not only is it related to oil, but if you look at the Russian economy, they have two products, weapon systems and energy. And outside of that, there's not much more to it. The other chart you're showing below that is the Russian ruble compared to the U.S. dollar. Now, that looks like further weakness ahead as well.
Yes, and this was priced through yesterday, so it hasn't even priced in what has occurred today for the ruble, which is another 1.3% weaker versus the dollar versus nearly 1.75% weaker yesterday. And if you and your viewers can just imagine what it looked like prior to the last 3 days, the setup was just so technically beautiful. My goodness, if it was a car, it may be a Pontiac GTO, or if it was a mountain, it may have been the Matterhorn. It was just so darn perfect that the setup suggested with great certainty that the move would be impetuous, sharp, and quick to the upside, where the dollar would strengthen further, the ruble would weaken further versus the US dollar. And then you can see the chart insert shows that we had two bases through last year, and then this year we've accelerated up through both of them. And then the weekly chart, which is the bigger look going back to 1994, suggests that this is going to take out the all-time high or the all-time weak levels for the ruble versus the dollar, which go back to 2016. I mean, you've never not gotten a move to a new high when this has started to accelerate. You've always gotten a move where the ruble has weakened to a new low, the dollar's moved to a new high versus the ruble. And I'm just looking at the chart historically, and it seems to me that we're going to get a similar type of move, especially with the EM weakness being pervasive. And we've seen what has happened today and over the past week to 2 weeks to 3 weeks for the Turkish lira as well. So my suggestion here is that the ruble will weaken further, weaken importantly, and the dollar will get to a new all-time high versus the ruble. The ruble will get to a new all-time low versus the dollar.
And let's go to the next major chart you have, which shows the dollar and the euro. And John, when I look at interest rates here, and in Europe, let's just take the spread. For example, a 10-year German Bund is almost have 2.25% more on a U.S. Treasury. And if you look at other interest rates in Europe, you would only have to go to troubled Italy. But even then, those rates are a fraction of what they have, let's say, what you can get in U.S. Treasuries. So is this one of the reasons why you see this relationship strengthening for the dollar?
Well, to be polite, I'm aware of the relationship you've just explained to us, but I'm trying to make my decisions just based on the price action. And the price action for the euro dollar, and I've created this chart here to show me and to whomever I show it, as well as you and your viewers, that the euro dollar, and this has been created synthetically, so it's really the Deutschmark going back prior to the euro dollar's nascent action. This is really an oscillator going back to the mid-70s, where the peak in the euro dollar is roughly around 1.5, and the bottom of the range is roughly around 0.85. And in the first iteration, you got way down to about 0.7. In the second iteration, you got to down to around 0.85. And in the third iteration, I don't think we're done yet with this decline. And I think that we had a rally last year through 2017 and early 2018 that was merely just a contra trend rally in what has been the overriding downtrend in force since 2008. You've had a series of lower highs and lower lows that was briefly interrupted with the 2017-2018 rally into about the 1.25 area. And it would not surprise me, Jim, and we've gotten some real weakness today in the euro, where it's down nearly 1% versus the dollar, and the dollar or the euro is down nearly 1.75% or thereabout on the week. We've had a sharp break below what was 2 months of support. It was not a base. That was just merely a ledge because it occurred beneath deteriorating moving averages. And I really think the euro is going to go importantly lower. And I'm going to use your explanation finally to give us the reasons why it's going importantly lower. The interest rate differentials clearly favor the United States. And I think that there's been too much complacency on the euro and potential growth in Europe. For example, over the wintertime, we had an army of people come through here telling us that the growth slowdown in Europe was merely temporary and weather related. And my reply was, that's not what the charts are telling us. The charts are telling us that there's something really wrong here. The banks in Europe have acted poorly. Clearly, the euro dollars acted really poorly. And Europe as a whole has really lagged the United States. So I thought that that weather excuse was a poor one at best. And I think that the next level down for this thing, the next important big number for the euro dollar is 1.10. And I think it's going to get there. And I think the euro is in a world of hurt.
You know, this brings up the question, too, about what the ECB is going to do. They're supposed to be ending quantitative easing, John, as you know. And they talked about postponing raising interest rates to maybe fall of next year. If the euro weakens and the economy weakens, and you have problems in Italy and also especially the vulnerability of European banks, you kind of question whether the ECB is going to be able to take the same route the Fed's doing.
I mean, at this stage, I think the ECB has a better chance of being a David Copperfield or Harry Houdini to get themselves out of the mess that they're in. And all you have to do, you and anybody who's listening, is take a look at what the chart for the FTSE MIB, the Italian index, looks like, which it was okay through the latter part of the autumn of 2017, early 2018. It was sort of sleepwalking and then had this tremendous acceleration into May. And since then, it's been really a disaster. And if you looked on a weekly basis, if we want to talk about oscillators, and I know you don't have the charts, I'll just try to verbalize it. Going back to 2009, the Italian market, the FTSE MIB, has had trouble every single time it's gotten up to about 24,500. Here it is today at 21,075. And the bottom of the range, Jim, and I'm being polite, the bottom of the range is 15,000 if we go back over the last 9 years. So just we could do the math in our minds. It was about 24,500 at its peak earlier in May. It's 21,079 today. And the bottom of the range is around 15,000. If things really come undone here and the pressure's really built, then Italy's down a lot from where it is. And I don't think that most people who are equity players, especially European equity players, are aware of what the potential risks here are for Italy.
I want to go to two other charts that you have, and I want to talk specifically on financials and then maybe related to what's going on here. You have a chart of Indian banks and Canadian banks, which are in upward trends. Let's talk about them for a minute.
Okay. So the Indian Bank Index, and I'll tell you, it's a Goldman Sachs India Banks Index. It's not mine. So I get the data from Goldman. So thank you, Mr. Goldman. The India Banks Index is the best bank index globally. It's up 11% year to date. And I pay attention to, I'm going to remember, it's 10 global bank index. The India Bank Index is the best bank index globally, head and shoulders, no technical pun intended, above everybody else. Canadian banks are in second place. They're up 2% year to date. The U.S. banks are in third, also around up 2%. The other seven global bank indexes are all lower on the year, including a China bank index, the Hang Seng Financials, the FTSE bank index, et cetera. And the reason I pay such close attention to the banks is because, A, how important they are on a market cap weighted basis to the respective indexes, but also how important they are to the global financial system. And if this was really, really a healthy market here in the U.S. and globally, we'd have better than 3 of 10 global bank indexes up on a year-to-date basis. And the fact that we only have one bank index that's up in double digits tells me that the environment is really not as strong as it is purported to be, and that we were having some sort of global synchronous recovery. I'm dubious on that. If we can only get one bank index up double digits year to date, I'm sending this to you, or I'm showing it here, because I just wanted to give an idea. Perhaps people aren't aware just how strong the India bank index sector has been. Again, it's the best one of the 10 that I monitor.
And let's relate that to what's going on with financials here in the U.S. If you take the ETF XLF, it has been struggling. It's been in an uptrend, but it looks like that's breaking. John, are you seeing the same thing here?
The XLF has been sideways since early January. It's fine. It's okay. It's not great. There's no reason really to hammer it here or be especially critical of it. I think it deserves the benefit of the doubt, but there are better places to be, I think, when you're looking for equity exposure. It's okay, and I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, but it's not dynamic.
Okay, one chart that looks like it's accelerating, and let's talk about that, and that's the NASDAQ Biotech Index.
I'm always trying to find sectors or indexes that look like they're about to come on or about to accelerate. And there's a lot of improvement within the healthcare space, and there's a lot of improvement within the biotech space. And the index itself, the NASDAQ Biotech, got right up into their January high, and it's been consolidating now for a month or so. And I think this is one where I'm going to do more work on, and perhaps your viewers will do more work on, that there may be something going forward for this. Because if there is a breakout for this index above the 3,800 level, and the July high of late, and which was roughly the January high, is about 3,775, 3,776. If we can get above there, I think there's some potential here. And I'm interested because I think it's built a base, and usually you tend to get tenured moves out of bases and then breakouts. So that's why I'm interested.
John, as you look at the U.S. markets and you look at the differentials that we see between, for example, you take the Qs, the NASDAQ, the Russell, which has been doing great this year, and then you take a look at the larger cap indexes like the S&P. The S&P looks like it's trying to reach its previous high in January, hasn't quite done that yet. And the Dow, industrials, and the transports have been struggling. Is this a dollar issue? Because obviously a higher dollar hurts the earnings of companies that are international. But, you know, once again, earnings have been stellar here in the U.S. What explains the difference between those major indexes? Because tech and consumer discretionary have been the dominant sectors to be in this year.
I'm going to give you a wise guy response, although I'm not being a wise guy to you. My response really is, if I want to be a wise guy, I have to ask my algorithm why this is happening. The answer is, I don't know why it's happening, Jim. So much of the money is now being managed not by people, but by machines. So much of the volume is run in a passive fashion, not by humans. I don't know why it's happening. I will tell you, however, that I am dubious on the Russell 2000 and why that's working. So my explanation is, yes, I realize the Russell 2000 is winning. I do not believe it is winning because small caps are doing better than big caps. I believe it is winning because more money, relatively more money, has been going into the IWM ETF vis-a-vis the SPY ETF. And here's my extended reasoning. There is no way on God's green earth that any big cap manager is selling the biggest of big caps to buy small cap stocks. There is not enough small cap to go around to satisfy anybody who's managing big cap money. So I think that is a shibboleth. I think it is an old wives' tale. No offense to anybody who's an old wife, but I think it is a Wall Street construct. It is merely because the IWM is getting more inflows than the SPY. That's why the Russell 2000 is doing better. Nearly one third of the companies in the Russell do not make money. So I don't believe that any big cap manager is selling Facebook, Google, what have you, in order to buy small cap stocks, because there's just not enough cap to go around. That's my example as to what I think is going on with respect to the Russell and the bigger cap indices. I think it is merely an ETF flow that is benefiting the Russell vis-a-vis the other indexes.
This brings up an interesting question. As you say, so much money today is being run by machines and also passive indexing. You know, if you're running a S&P index fund, a Q index fund, as a manager, you're not asking questions. If Amazon or Apple is a percentage of the index, you just simply buy. You don't ask questions. How much of this is distorting what we're seeing in the markets today? As you just mentioned, you're questioning the Russell.
I think it's distorting it a lot, Jim. I really do. I mean, well, we've talked about this before, you and I, but without adjusting the technology market cap weight in the S&P 500, without adjusting it, is 26%. If we adjusted it to add in Netflix, Booking, and Amazon, you'd be at about 32%. That's a historic high. It's affecting the price action and the behavior a lot. It's certainly affecting the behavior of purchases and the way purchases are conducted with respect to passive funds, et cetera. And if anybody is managing an active fund, the only way that they can keep pace with the passives or the indexes is to stay very closely hugged to those benchmarks. These managers are forced, and by dint of having to perform, to be close to their benchmarks. There's almost no way to outperform if the market's going up and you're away from your benchmark without owning those big guys.
You know, this just kind of reminds me of something that has never been stress test before, because, John, we've talked about the proliferation of index passive investing, whether it's ETFs or mutual funds. You've got machines running the markets today as well. And the other thing is the concentration. The Wall Street Journal talked about three entities control 88% of the S&P 500 index. You have a high concentration of financial firms that control the markets. And then on top of that, you have liquidity issues. So if you have three entities that control the S&P 500, John, what happens when it comes to liquidation? Who is going to be on the other side of the trade if they need to sell Amazon at $1,800 a share?
Jim, I'm afraid I'm not smart enough to answer your question. It's something that I think about a lot. I think about this stuff all the time. We know how these things work on the way up. We don't know how they work on the way down. I think it'll be an uncomfortable education for nearly everybody when it happens. I'm not good enough to know when it's going to happen. I just hope that my eyes are open when it's occurring so I can avoid getting run over.
Final question, if I may, John. Given what you're seeing in the charts right now, what would you be doing as an investor?
I think if you're an owner of the indexes, you're generally okay. I think that we're in an environment where if there are going to be sharp corrections, we're likely not going to be able to protect ourselves, because I think that they'll happen fairly quickly. There's a great degree of complacency, a great degree of complacency. In fact, if you are an investor, you're likely saying to yourself that the market has ignored a ton of bad news, trade tariffs, et cetera, all the way across currency situations. And it's all true. But I don't know if the market's ignored the bad news or the algos haven't been programmed to account for these issues. I'm sure it's the latter relative to the former. So, but if you own the indexes, you're generally fairly well insulated. I'm of the belief that corrective phases, when they occur, will happen in a very short, sharp fashion. And hopefully we'll be on our toes so we can move without the ball.
Yeah, we saw a good example of that in the last week of January and early weeks of February. John, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Once again, we're going to make John's charts available at our website. John, if our listeners would like to follow you, how can they do so?
Hey, Jim, thanks very much for your kindness as always. And it's very nice of you to say so. But the firm I work for is on the buy side and my charts sort of stay in-house. So very much. Perhaps next time when I'm on, I'll show 10 other ones.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us, John. And once again, listeners, we will make John's charts available on our website. John, have yourself a great week and a great rest of the summer.
You too, Jim. Thanks a lot for your time. Thanks for having me.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This kind of crisis, this trade war between the United States and China, really has the potential of being a turning point in history. President Trump believes that China is a grave threat to the United States. And that's what he has said again and again. And he has put in office Peter Navarro, who wrote a book called Death by China. And it looks like they really intend to hold China's feet to the fire. And China is not going to stand by and be intimidated and capitulate. China is going to fight back.
Well, since reaching a low late last year, the dollar has been on a rise this year. Will Fed rate hikes continue to cause the dollar to break out, or is it peaking? Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman. Mark, let's talk about the dollar, and in particular, the interest rate spreads that we see now in the U.S., with the Fed most likely to increase rates in September and a probability of another hike in December, and where rates are in Europe. So as you look at the dollar, where it stands now, is it about to break out? We got here late last year, and then we went down, but we're right back up to where we were towards the end of last year. What happens going forward?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, because I think that this was so important about just the timing of our conversation today, is that last week, it looked to me like the dollar had broken out higher. And this week, we've got some strong follow-through dollar gains. So what was happening is after the dollar had weakened in the beginning of the year, it recovered, but then went broadly sideways through the spring and early summer. And the breakout's taking place, it looks like the dollar's upside, and it's across the board. But what scares me for the immediate future, so I'm cautioning not to go out and chase the market right now, because for the first time that I can remember, most of the major currencies, leaving aside the Canadian dollar and the Japanese yen, are going to finish, most likely today, outside of their Bollinger Bands. And remember, the Bollinger Band is a two standard deviation envelope around the 20-day moving average. And it's just a sense of how extreme recent moves have been. I'm not saying using it as the only trading tool, but it just illustrates that this move that we've seen in the dollar, especially in the last few days, has accelerated and leaves it a bit stretched, even though I still like the dollar in the longer term.
So anytime you see a movement like this, and especially what we've seen in the dollar since March, it's been almost parabolic except recently here. Is it not unusual in trading for it maybe to consolidate for a bit as these other currencies, as you talk about, are in extreme ends of their Bollinger Bands?
Yeah, so I know that's what I'm kind of looking at. It's some near-term consolidation. You know, this is the summer months. Summer weeks, I suppose, and I think that there's been an exhaustion. It seems like me, it's almost like, it feels like capitulation. For example, the euro had been holding above 115, and not only did we break 115 today, we broke 114 just now. That is to say, we're trading with a 113 handle on the euro. What a reversal from above 120 where we had been. And the same kind of story for the Australian dollar, British pound. You know, the British pound is down the sixth consecutive week. And I think this speaks to what you were saying before about this chronic cost of being short the dollar, the interest rate differential, just for example, on three-month money. One can pick up over 200 basis points. Being long dollars, this is an annualized rate, being long dollars over, let's say, being long LIBOR over Euribor. So that the interest rate differential, I think, just this is what we've seen, I think, is when you have expanding fiscal policy, tight monetary policy, capital gets sucked into that country. That's what we had in the U.S. with Reagan and Volcker. And at that time, that dollar rally took the G7 to intervene at the Plaza Accord to stop that dollar from rallying.
Mark, what is going to change this dynamic? Because as you mentioned, if you look at the spreads, for example, between German bonds and U.S. treasuries, and the fact that it looks like the Fed is still going to be raising interest rates, so the possibility those spreads even widen, what is to stop the dollar from going up long term if our economy is doing better because of stimulus and interest rates are higher? What's to stop the dollar?
Yes, I don't really see anything like a macro fundamental that stopped the dollar, but that story alone, that narrative also has sort of a shelf life. So first we have to ask ourselves, then if we're trying to look for the, where's the dollar going to peak, or what's going to be those events, or what kind of time frame? So I say, well, first, when is the Fed going to get done raising interest rates? I suspect it'll be sometime around the middle of next year. Now, the Federal Reserve, of course, doesn't agree with me, and many other people don't either, of course, but it's worth like thinking about when you think that the Fed funds, when you think the Fed will stop raising rates. And if I'm right around the middle of next year or so, when is the ECB going to begin raising interest rates?
Well, they tell us they're going to raise interest. They can raise interest rates beginning at the end, after next summer. So somewhere around the time when the Fed gets done raising rates, I think that's when the ECB begins. And so what I'm really looking at is a very desynchronized business cycle, sort of like the great financial crisis has really like a huge boulder, and it's really changed relationships and maybe the proximity or the closeness, the synchronicity of business cycles.
Right now, you've got a rising dollar, you've got rising oil prices, and rising interest rates. In many ways, that could be considered a tightening, because rising oil takes dollars out of consumer pocketbooks. Rising interest rates, we're seeing a peak in housing and autos. And of course, a rising dollar also, well, it makes goods that we import cheaper, but also makes it more difficult for corporate earnings.
Yes, that's what I'm sort of thinking happening, is that we are accumulating late cycle behavior and a tightening of financial conditions. And that's why I think next week in the U.S. we get some housing data. This is going to be an interest rate sensitive market. And also, because of the tariffs, the price of homes, this is the lumber tariff on Canada, the price of building a house has gone up. And so I'm looking at that as a sign of also when interest rates begin biting, when financial conditions that you described begin biting, one of the things you expect is interest rate sensitive sectors begin feeling the pinch first. But I'm also looking at the 12-month moving average non-farm payrolls. That typically peaks in the middle of the cycle. It peaked in 2015. I'm looking at another interest rate sensitive sector. Another sector that's going to be hit by tariffs is the auto sector. And so that's the biggest item many consumers will be able to buy. And it looks like that peaked on a 12-month moving average, just to smooth out some of the noise, peaked a couple of years ago. We got the yield curve flattening, which is also typically late cycle. As you mentioned, higher oil prices. And this is an interesting one. Almost every U.S. recession has been preceded by a rally in oil prices. Now, I'm kind of wondering how much oil prices are going to rally from here, because I sort of see these two macro forces that are impacting supply. On one hand, you have the three largest producers in the world, U.S., Russia, Saudi Arabia, and all three of them are committed to boosting output. I know there's been some noise in the recent data, but we know that all three countries want to boost output. And on the other hand, you've got the sanctions, the embargo that's going to go into effect against Iranian oil in a few months. The markets, it seems to me, just talking with different people in the market, coming around to a consensus that the embargo is not going to be as effective as the last one, but could still remove 1 million barrels a day from supply.
Well, you know, several countries, from European countries, China and others, and India, are saying they're going to work around this. So that could be an issue where not as many barrels are removed from the market as once thought. But the combination of these three, you know, you mentioned that every recession in the past was preceded with rising oil prices, but they were also preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle. But what makes this cycle so unusual, Mark, as you know, you normally don't get a stimulus like we got put into effect with additional spending. Congress is going to spend close to $700 billion, of which $300 will be spent this year and next year. And next year, the combination of tax cuts and spending is going to add about $460 billion to the U.S. economy. So can that stimulus, despite the rate hikes in oil prices, keep this economy and market going for much longer than most people think?
Yeah, no, you're right. There is a lot of fiscal stimulus in the pipeline. And that, of course, is extending this already long business cycle. But for me, the key, though, is not so much, I recognize what you're saying. The fiscal stimulus, I think, is the really most important thing for trying to forecast or trying to understand where the U.S. economy is going right now. But on the other hand, what bothers me is that here we are, 3 years into the Fed's tightening, began December 2015. And the real Fed funds rate, so you take the Fed funds target, 1.75 to 2%, subtract CPI from it to give you a real Fed funds rate. And we are still at a negative real Fed funds rate. In the past, it's taken a negative real Fed funds rate to get the economy to recover from a recession. And so what are we really talking about when the Fed stops raising interest rates? The real Fed funds rate will be slightly positive. And so we begin the next cycle then, and that's what bothers me on the downturn, with monetary policy still very easy, with a very low real Fed funds rate, and this fiscal stimulus, which exhausts the political will for any further fiscal stimulus. That's an old line from Ronald Reagan.
So I guess the real question here is we've got tax cuts, we've got additional fiscal spending that is coming at the end of a business cycle, which is most unusual. So two questions here, Mark. If we get into another downturn, another recession, another bear market, what does the government do when the Fed really has not been able to raise interest rates that much compared to previous cycles, number one? And number two, the government just spent a whole lot of money and with tax cuts. What do they do during the next downturn?
Well, monetary policy is already, like you say, interest rates are low. So how much stimulus can the Fed provide? And I think that this is what we find in these surveys. You ask like banker types, economists, where is the Fed's balance sheet going to be in, say, 2 years from now or 5 years from now? And so they have it. Balance sheet still falling, the Fed's balance sheet, but then they have it rising again. Well, why would it rise? It would rise because in the next business downturn, Fed can't cut the Fed funds rate sufficiently for stimulus, bounded by that zero. I think the Fed is loath to cut interest rates below zero. And so they'll do QE again, rebuild the Fed's balance sheet. So I think on monetary policy, the Fed has shown that it can invent like new pages in the playbook. Fiscal policy is a different story, but there we get, I think, into the election cycle. And so we get to the Republicans now are pushing for some more sort of tax reform 2.0, they call it, I think, which makes some new tax cuts, but also makes permanent the middle class tax cuts. And so that's going to get them through, I guess that would be a campaign issue come November. But then what happens in 2020? And there, I think, and this is where I think the timing could be just right for President Trump, is that the Federal Reserve gets done tightening middle of 2019. Maybe I'm a little bit early. Maybe it's the third quarter or something like that. But maybe by the time that the election's coming around, maybe the Federal Reserve could afford to cut interest rates. And why would they cut interest rates? They cut interest rates because the economy's slowing. And so they get the rate cut it'd be a nice story to be able to tell.
Sure. And especially if they start cutting interest rates, that drives money in the markets. And speaking of money going into the markets, I'd like to get your perspective. And I've asked this from a lot of the experts we've had on the program. So much of what is done in the markets today is algo trading. In other words, between algo trading and passive investing, a lot of the fundamental questions that would normally be asked by fund managers, you don't have those questions being asked. It's being run by machines. In mindless investing, as money goes into a passive index fund. A passive index fund, Mark, manager, as you know, just does, they get money in, they buy the stocks in the index, money goes out, they sell the stocks in the index. So what impact do you think that would have on the markets today, and how much of a distortion is that creating?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think I see this issue being really debated extensively in the financial pages. And I think that for me, here's the problem is that the passive investing, the indexing and the ETF, I think that the business that they squeeze is not so much the fund manager who trades his own ideas. I think that the people that those ETF squeezes are sort of the closet trackers, the people who charge a fee to essentially track the index without really calling themselves the index. And so I do think that there's probably room for both. That is for the type of portfolio manager who thinks they can beat the stock market. But I hear you. I mean, I think a lot of people, especially working for active fund managers in some fashion, they want to preserve this claim. And the claim is, I think, that these passive investments are putting the market at risk. And I don't know how to evaluate that, What I do know, though, is that we've just had this period that we've sort of talked about chronic bubbles, chronic crises, rolling crises from one sector to another. And passive investing wasn't involved with that. So we've had so-called the dominance of active fund managers. And I don't know if you remember, but the 1987 equity market crashed 25% in one day. 2008, 2009, this was not because of passive fund managers. And so new products will contribute to the next downturn, will contribute to the next financial crisis. I can accept that. But I'm not so sure how much of it's from the passive side. And I also hear you about the AI. You know, my son went to a high school in New York and he played baseball. For the school newspaper, the baseball like box score would be entered into a computer, and the computer would write the game summary. I know that the Financial Times and Bloomberg have experimented with using AI to write news reports. So I think that this is, I think we're in the middle of this, you know, rapid technology transition. And what we think is, what we think should be like humans, or we're surprised by the extent of the robots and AI. I think that is more than, becomes more incumbent on us as investors and as people, citizens, to then find other ways to add value in that crude economic sort of logic. We can do things that robots can't do. It's sort of like what happens after we have cameras that can take pictures, perfect pictures of reality. Artists don't have to anymore.
Given where we are now and what you think may be happening to the dollar, from your perspective as an investor, what would you be doing, or what are you recommending?
Well, yes, these days, you know, I'm scared like everybody else is. Stock market seems very rich. The political climate, you never know the volatility from a tweet. And so I'm waiting for new opportunities to commit more cash, but I don't see this opportunity as being now.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Mark, as our listeners follow you, tell them the easiest way that they could do so.
Sure, thanks. The best way to follow me is my blog, Mark to Market. The second best way would be on Twitter, and there you can find me as Mark Making Sense, which is really a title of play on a title of a book of mine called Making Sense of the Dollar. I recently came out with another book called Political Economy of Tomorrow. There's a guy who worked at the same bank I do now, but 100 years ago. And I took his ideas, and I really showed how like insightful they were into the 21st century. Political Economy of Tomorrow.
As always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have a great weekend and a great rest of the summer.
Hey, thank you. Good luck to everybody.
We thank you for joining us for the first half of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 2, The Big Picture, we talk about why defense wins championships inside the bubble. We'll be discussing the mindless algorithmic trading that accrues shares to ETFs, but also the various options available to investors outside of the stock market to find returns in today's market. Coming up on The Big Picture.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.